So we left off, I just asked you the relationship between the Canadian soldiers and the American soldiers.
Generally good. Culture shock between the way each of us did things. A definite feeling of unease on our part in the lines and in the trenches with the Americans, partially due to not understanding totally the way they did things, but also the feeling we had that perhaps the PDCI would be a little better in that situation. The Americans had a lot of draftees. The unit that we were with, I'd say practically half of them, or more than half, were draftees. And they were really green, some of them, very, very green. So it was kind of, you'd get an uneasy feeling knowing that if you were in an OP, and our OP was the very tip of the hook, that some of the people in the fire pits just down below you, which is the only thing between you and the Chinese, had less than a year in.
Did that affect morale?
Didn't affect our morale, but it made us very, very cohesive and very, very vigilant in such things as setting up our own OP and understanding what was going on around us, and also and making sure we had the best damned artillery support we could possibly get, because that was the only thing we had. Mm-hmm.
So being on a position like the Hook, traditional invasion, did you, during your time there, was there any major confrontations?
Oh, about three or four.
Really?
But not, we were never overrun. And I would say that of the major bombardment shellings or activity that we had, only one of them would have been an attempt at a full-scale attack. And in that one, the Chinese were spotted, probably near the start line, and everything under the sun was thrown at them. And anyway, that didn't come off. But they would precede these things with an enormous concentration of artillery. They'd bring their artillery in from all over the place, and then suddenly cut loose. And so you could barely even move. You couldn't do a whole lot. And the first thing to go usually was communication. And when communications went, as we used to say, you're kind of useless as a signaler if you can't talk to anybody. Consequently, it meant that some of our people were crawling the trenches, pulling these disposable wire dispensers behind them, trying to keep a line in and get a line up to the OP, which is a long, long way away.
How long it took?
In distance? I don't know exactly the distance, but it would take us a trip through a full trench system and a couple of crawl trenches to get to our OP, or one crawl trench and then into a small trench leading to the back of our OP. We were at the very tip of the hook. The company command post was at the rear, and also our main bunker, the main communications bunker, was in the rear.
So you said that with these confrontations, the majority of them were not attempts to overrun it?
No, you could never tell. I mean, because they all opened up the same way. I mean, there'd be activity, there'd be reports, there would be a sudden increase in shelling, and so you didn't know whether that was going to be the moment, or whether they were just a feint, or whether they were covering some other activity that they were doing. There was always a tug of war over all the little fingers and hills next to us. And they'd be up on there one night, and our people would be out the next, or they'd both be out there on one night, and then that would cause quite a fracas. And again, there'd be shelling from both sides.
Would you know that an attack was going to happen before the shelling, or was the shelling the first sign that the Chinese were mounting an attack?
That's the way we saw it. Generally, they proceeded with a very pretty devastating artillery barrage. And that's the way, at least in the history of the Hook that I've seen it, every one of the times they were overrun, the trenches were almost reduced to nothing by the time they came over the top.
So you had no warning before the artillery barrage? Or just started?
On a few occasions, I don't think we did. On a few occasions, it sort of came out of the blue, but in others, you get an increase in shelling, Harrison fire, whatnot. And we'd be sending shell reps back all the time. You could see them escalating throughout the day. And generally, after first light, there'd be some reports of movement and whatnot, and then they'd show it.
Okay, so this is your time while the entire Commonwealth Division was on leave, which includes the Canadians, and it was 2 months, you said?
About 2 months.
What happened when the Canadians came back?
That was interesting in that they took up the line. They took up the their former positions. We all moved over on the line, away from the hook at that time. And they took over the former positions. In our case, it was funny. I think I told you about the situation that occurred, that in order to have a seamless transition between the two places, our OP officer stayed with the Americans because the British Black Box were coming in. So he was going to orient them to the hook. But our OP crew went off to our new OP and joined the British OP officer there. Found out that we were firing New Zealand guns, which was sort of unusual, and that we were with the Siamese battalion. And they were very nice people, but very, very strange to work with, communications being the initial problem. And so we got on well with them for about a week. Worked with them, and then they, on the day that we were to do the changeover, they waited, and then left. They decided it was midnight, and it was time to go, and so they left, and I remember the British OP officer came into our communications bunker at the time. He said, "Gentlemen," he said, "we own this hill," he said. And we looked around, and immediately there were about three or four. Luckily there was an infantry sergeant there, and I think he had a private with him. He came up with a dance party. We all fanned out from that area, manning the OP in as many of the most crucial fire pits as you could. And that went on for about 2 hours until finally the PPCLI company that got lost found themselves and came up there and took over, nonchalantly.
So at this point, you were no longer on the hook, or you were just...
No, this wasn't on the hook. In fact, this was, comparatively speaking, much quieter.
But did you still experience harassment fire? And
oh, yes. Yeah. You would then. And then that's sort of a daily occurrence.
Okay. Yeah. And what was your general job at this point?
At that, I was an OPAC at that time. I was a signaler in charge, but also the sort of charge of the OP crews and also acting as an OPAC. An OPAC assistant simply assists the OP, OP officer in technical gun range spotting.
Do you know generally what time this would be?
March?
March 52?
Yeah.
Okay.
We'd have made the move in about March, I guess.
So, what happened next, do you recall?
We stayed up at that OP for, I don't know the exact time.
Yeah, no, that's...
We did our tour up there, and then we were relieved, I think, by a different OP crew. A different group there. At least not all of us, but some of us were sort of rotated out. I went back to the gun position, and at that time was running supplies up to the OPs and also to our attack headquarters. And basically, other than going out on the odd patrols and whatnot, because at that time we started to get active on patrols, supporting the Americans again. Other than going out on patrols, it was mainly back in the encampment.
What did the patrols consist of?
There are a number of reasons to go out with them, but one of the biggest ones was the Americans were trying to put up a large concertina wire fence right across the entire San Juan Valley to seal off a part of the valley that they'd been using it for infiltrating all the time, and they were going through there all the time. So they were trying to seal this off, and they had a working party out there almost every night. And we would go forward on with an American U.S. patrol, and we'd go forward with them far as we could. There was a natural dike that ran across the San Juan, and it was a very good defensive position. And we'd take a position on this dike and act as a blocking force in case, you know, the Chinese came through to these people. And basically that was the main sort of patrols that we were doing at that time, more or less blocking for the Chinese. But we had altercations there. and one of the worst firefights I've ever been in. That we really didn't know. We were in this on this dike, and suddenly flares went off behind us. They were fired in front of us, of course, but they went off behind us, illuminating our whole dike, and then the firefight started, and it was very, very intense, and I was trying to get artillery fire down. We had good communications. Our OPs were looking down at us, and I gave the order for an immediate battery target, and I got a pause, wait out. Very unusual in a something like that going on. And during the time that we were waiting for wait out, of course we were watching to see whether these people were coming up or whatnot. And just then, the a fellow came running up the back of our trench, a little hole we were in, and I thought he was one of the whoever it was firing on, but he wasn't. It was the light machine gun from the left flank of our position, and he was manning it. And he was in behind talking to the patrol leader, saying that the Chinese had come up and pulled his friend out of the pit and took him away. That meant there was no machine gun on the other side. And anyway, just about that time, I got through on the set and was our major battery commander, Murdoch, who'd been tracking this whole thing all the time. And he said, I think what you've got out there is I think you're having a firefight with another American patrol. And he said, they're trying to contact them now, because they're not too sure where they were. This was a patrol that was advancing to actually make contact with the Chinese. That was their purpose. And sure enough, they contacted them, and the firing died down and whatnot. And here was another patrol that was out, and they just lost track of the fact that either they were off course or they weren't coordinating very, very well. But it took the gunner network, to sort out what was going on. And I'll remember the sheepish staff sergeant came from the patrol leader that came up to talk to the other fellow about it. You know, they felt a little bad about, you know, starting the war. And then he asked to borrow our communications because we had a pretty well direct line to their battalion headquarters. And he asked if he could change the role of his patrol, because by now every Chinaman all around knew exactly where they were, who they were, and everything. And I was really surprised that they came back and said, no, continue on to contact.
No, is that an American order?
American patrol, yeah. So he did, and we did a bon voyage, and he disappeared up the, in front of us up the road, and it wasn't 20 minutes later then they all of a sudden a huge mortar barrage about this bridge, and they were caught on the bridge. The Chinese couldn't believe the gift they were getting.
So these, this is when you're running patrols with the Americans. And you were still in the position with the PPCR at this point, or was this?
Okay, this is where I'm having a little trouble, because I think we were. We actually had, the brigade had changed over, and we had come out of the OP, and we're back at the gun position at that time, and we were being drawn for these patrols from the gun position.
And you had been?
And we were providing, we provide an OP officer, and myself, a signaler, and act to go out with their patrols to provide the kind of support that we could give them.
How long did you spend there doing the patrols?
They were intermittent. I mean, they would do. Sometimes you'd go out a couple of nights at a time, and then it'd be a long period, but somebody else probably was doing it, and then you'd go out again, because other subunits were providing people as well.
So when you weren't patrolling, what was your job?
Working at the command post, running supplies up to our OPs and whatnot, and maintaining the line forward to that. And this was getting close to our rotation date at that time. And it was amazing how difficult it was to find people to go forward of the gun position.
What rank were you at this point?
Still a lance quality.
Okay. When was your rotation date?
I think it was in, I was trying to look that up, so I think it was April.
April, and this was March. So you were rotated out of Korea in April then?
Yeah, April, May, in there somewhere. I don't know whether it was, we must have crossed into May going out, yeah.
Did you you mentioned before that you were Kane's room 5 days R&R. Did you get that?
Yeah. After about 9 months, I guess. Actually, we got it for Christmas.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So were you... Were
because of our little group that went out to Porthole, you see, there were various ways of getting back at us. And one of them was we were last on the R&R list. So on Christmas, we managed to... New Year's, sorry. It was New Year's, yeah. We managed to get away for 5 days to Tokyo. And I got lucky and caught the terrible flu that was going on just on the last day of R&R, and they had to keep me there another 3 days.
So you were rotated out of Korea in May 53?
April, May.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get back to Canada?
We came back. They did a very nice thing. They staged this, maybe it's in memory of what happened in Yokohama, because they sent our troop commander back with all of the regimental funds they accumulated for the entire year in our canteens and everything else, sent him back to Puri, Japan, to arrange entertainment and whatnot for us for the 4 or 5 days that we were in Japan being decompressed and processed before we got on the American troop ship. And they did a tremendous job. We arrived there, and we were in tents, of course, but they had buses laid on, and they had cruise boats to the inland sea, and banquets, and, you know, this sort of thing. It was pretty well, nicely.
And that was for about 5 days?
Probably a little less, probably about 4 days. And during all this time, there was quite a bit of processing going on. A lot of individual records and so on, they probably weren't as well kept up in line as they should have been. This was a good place to do it before we went back. Then we joined, by bus, I suppose, and we ended up at another one of these American wonderful troop ships, and it took another 14 days to get back to Seattle.
What were the conditions like on that troop ship?
Identical to the one before.
Yeah.
Terrible. Boring.
What happened when you got back to Seattle?
Seattle, they actually had a CPR train right there on the dock. We got off the boat onto this train, and they just pushed off almost immediately from Canada and started taking us back. Ran out of milk within 2 hours of the train leaving, and they had to stop somewhere along the way and pick it up.
I've heard that, did you have a choice to then leave the military, or were you...
Pardon?
Did you have a choice to leave the military after Korea?
No. I think I had to sign on before I left. Another 3 years ago.
Coming back to Canada and Canada's response to the Korean War was basically non-existent.
Yeah. Although in our case, there was a peculiar thing to do, but the CO was quite a... He was General McLaughlin's son. He changed his name to Leslie. But anyway, he decided to keep the regiment together until they got to Winnipeg. And then we would parade in Winnipeg from the train station down Main Street to Portage Avenue, and they had a band there, and so on and so forth. And there was a fair number of people out there. It was kind of a reasonable homecoming. That had a downside, though, in that a lot of people that could have been home were still on that train. And the train got into, was going to arrive in Winnipeg too early. So we stopped in Portage du Prairie, and that's only about 50 miles from Winnipeg. Stayed there overnight. And I can imagine the married people out there with their wives in Shiloh and Winnipeg, and they're sitting on this train after 13 months away, sort of thing. But they did that, and had their parade the next day.
Did the reaction, other than the parade, the general just fact that no one really knew what was going on and what you guys were sacrificing in Korea, did that bother you at all? The forgotten war stigma?
I think we kind of expected.
Really?
Well, at least when I left, once we'd broken away from the regiment and I'd got back to Winnipeg and was talking to people that I knew, or old friends of mine or friends of yours and whatnot, I mean, they weren't totally ignorant of Korea, but they just didn't know. And it had no impact on them. I don't think we expected much more.
Really? Did it seem to you North Korea, a communist aggressor attacking South Korea, was it more of a political... Did soldiers sign up because of the communist threat, or was it more because...
I doubt it.
You don't know?
No, I doubt if they did sign up because of the communist threat.
Did that seem like a big deal while you were in Korea, that it was a communist
aggression? Yeah, it was serious. I mean, we it was a big menace then. Mm-hmm. We saw it that way. But there was another motivation there for anybody that was able to get away from the lines and get back to have a look at Korea, at the people in Korea. The impact of the hardship and the terrible things going on there was enough to really make you very, very annoyed at the North.
Was there much interaction with South Korean civilians?
No. Because of the fact that we had the lines, by the time they hit the 38th parallel, they cleared them all back, all the way back to the second line of defense, which was the Kansas one. So we didn't see many. There was a lot of them working with us, from young lads to, they called them Korean Service Corps, they were laborers. But we didn't see much of the ordinary Korean life until you went back to Wijongbu, or back to Seoul. And then you would see such things as, I went to the hospital back there, and went in to have, you carry your mess tins. I got a mess tin full of food, and I was eating my food, and I had to look out, and there were Korean women with their children standing outside this big fence right where the garbage cans were parked, with a bowl holding it out, so that if you came out, you would dump your mess tin in the bowl. And that was the kind of hardship you'd see around there. And little wee kids, little wee girls with a little wee baby on it. You know, and lots of orphans. There were the Canadian orphans in Seoul at the time.
Was that seen by a regular soldier, or did you just see that because of your trip to the hospital?
Only those of us that got back to Seoul. Some of them really never got too far out of the line other than to go to on R&R or something like that. I got back a few times to Seoul, either hospital or maybe transporting someone to the airport there, or whatnot, or back to the British station.
So you would get to see a lot more of the effects on Korea than the normal soldier would?
On the population.
Yeah. Did that have a big effect on you?
It did on me, yeah. Yeah, it made me realize that it's a terribly, terribly devastating thing.
So when you got back to Canada, were you still a Lens?
Still a Lens volunteer.
You retired a major?
Yeah.
When were you promoted?
I stayed in the artillery up until about 1971. Worked my way up to gunnery instructor. And then I was leaving the forces. I had a degree, and I had an acceptance for a graduate degree in U of T. But at that time, there was an offer out to go into the specialist branch, because I had a psychology qualification. And they were trying to recruit people from civilian life to come in. So I took the commission in personnel selection.
When you signed up in 1949, after World War II, the Canadian military basically disbanded. There was only the three regiments. Was there a similar effect after the Korean War?
No. Because the year we were away, they really built up this NATO commitment to Europe, and that was growing, and I think that's where all the political interest was, on Korea. And so when we came back, we saw quite a lot of activity, and the force was bigger, from about 51 to 53. It was an extra regiment we saw in 1 month. When I joined 1RCHA, there was two batteries, C battery and A battery. And they weren't real batteries. They wouldn't be bigger than Kirby. And then when they started the airborne unit, then they started to grow from there. When we came back in 1953, I think there were four. So, regiments.
Looking back on Korea, especially when you returned, maybe just a few years after, looking back on Korea, did you regret going? Because I know you volunteered to go and took a cut in pay to do so.
No, I never regretted going, because I thought that was the point of our time in the forces. So I never regretted going. I've often looked back, and even while I was there, looked at the disarray of the Canadian response to expeditions such as that. And this is mainly political. The fact that they would have, as I said, a brigade on land, Air Force flying into some other destination for the Americans, Navy patrolling up and down, shooting at trains off the coast, and none of them talking to one another. It's always bothered me. In fact, I was probably one of the few people when Hellyer came along with this so-called unification that was foreign, because I thought maybe that would cure it, but that went off the rails completely. But it looks like they're looking at it once again.
Mm-hmm. So you take Korea in general, would you think a positive experience or negative experience?
I think personally it was positive. Particularly now when I meet a lot of the fellows who were there, and we have odd associations. And there's quite a camaraderie from that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that covers most of the questions I had to ask. Is there anything you wanted to ask?
I don't think so. I think as far as recollections are concerned, that's as far as I want to go. I'm trying to keep this down as much as I can to exactly what I did or saw, not what I think should have happened. But no, I think that's good enough.
Well, thank you very much.